ever had from anyone except my mother. And second, a country school board at a place called Happy Hollow hired me to teach at a salary of $2 a day, or $40 a month. Now, here was even more evidence of somebody's faith in me. Third, as soon as I got my first check, I bought some store clothes, clothes that I wasn't ashamed to wear. If someone gave me $1 million now, it wouldn't thrill me half as much as that first suit of clothes for which I paid only a few dollars. Fourth, the real turning point in my life, the first great victory in my struggle against embarrassment and inferiority, occurred at the Putnam County Fair, held annually in Bainbridge, Indiana. My mother had urged me to enter a public speaking contest that was to be held at the fair. To me, the very idea seemed fantastic. I didn't have the courage to talk to even one person, let alone a crowd. But my mother's faith in me was almost pathetic. She dreamed great dreams for my future. She was living her own life over in her son. Her faith inspired me to enter the contest. I chose for my subject about the last thing in the world that I was qualified to talk on, the fine and liberal arts of America. Frankly, when I began to prepare the speech, I didn't know what the liberal arts were, but it didn't matter much because my audience didn't know either. I memorized my flowery talk and rehearsed it to the trees and cows 100 times. I was so eager to make a good showing for my mother's sake that I must have spoken with emotion. At any rate, I was awarded first prize. I was astounded at what happened. A cheer went up from the crowd. The very boys who'd once ridiculed me and poked fun at me and called me hatchet face now slapped me on the back and said, "I knew you could do it, Elmer." My mother put her arms around me and sobbed. As I look back in retrospect, I can see that winning that speaking contest was the turning point of my life. The local newspapers ran an article about me on the front page and prophesied great things for my future. Winning that contest put me on the map locally and gave me prestige, and what's far more important, it multiplied my confidence 100-fold. I now realize that if I'd not won that contest, I probably would never have become a member of the United States Senate, for it lifted my sights, widened my horizons, and made me realize that I had latent abilities that I never dreamed I possessed. Most important, however, was the fact that the first prize in the oratorical contest was a year's scholarship in the Central Normal College. I hungered now for more education, so during the next few years, from 1896 to 1900, I divided my time between teaching and studying. In order to pay my expenses at DePaul University, I waited on tables, looked after furnaces, mowed lawns, kept books, worked in the wheat and corn fields during the summer, and hauled gravel on a public road construction job. In 1896, when I was only 19, I made 28 speeches urging people to vote for William Jennings Bryan for president. The excitement of speaking for Bryan aroused a desire in me to enter politics myself. So when I entered DePaul University, I studied law and public speaking. In 1899, I represented the university in a debate with Butler College, held in Indianapolis, on the subject, "Resolved that United States Senators should be elected by popular vote." Well, I won other speaking contests and became editor-in-chief of the Class of 1900 college annual, The Mirage, and the university paper, The Palladium. After receiving my A.B. degree at DePaul, I took Horace Greeley's advice, only I didn't go west, I went southwest. I went down to a new country, Oklahoma, when the Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache Indian Reservation was opened. I homesteaded a claim and opened a law office in Lawton, Oklahoma. I served in the Oklahoma State Senate for 13 years, in the lower house of Congress for 4 years, and at 50 years of age, I achieved my lifelong ambition. I was elected to the United States Senate from Oklahoma. I've served in that capacity since March 4, 1927. Since Oklahoma and Indian Territories became the state of Oklahoma on November 16, 1907, I have been continuously honored by the Democrats of my adopted state by nominations, first for state Senate and for Congress, and later for the United States Senate. I've told this story not to brag about my own feeling of accomplishment, which can't possibly interest anyone else. I've told it wholly with the hope that it may give renewed courage and confidence to some poor boy who's now suffering from the worries and shyness and feeling of inferiority that devastated my life when I was wearing my father's cast-off clothes and gaiter shoes that almost dropped off my feet as I walked. It's interesting to know that Elmer Thomas, who was so ashamed of his ill-fitting clothes as a youth, was later voted the best-dressed man in the United States Senate. I Lived in the Garden of Allah by R.V.C. Bodley, descendant of Sir Thomas Bodley, founder of the Bodleian Library, Oxford, author of Wind in the Sahara, The Messenger, and 14 other volumes. In 1918, I turned my back on the world I had known and went to Northwest Africa and lived with the Arabs in the Sahara, the Garden of Allah. I lived there 7 years. I learned to speak the language of the nomads. I wore their clothes, I ate their food, and adopted their mode of life, which has changed very little during the last 20 centuries. I became an owner of sheep and slept on the ground in the Arabs' tents. I also made a detailed study of their religion. In fact, I later wrote a book about Muhammad entitled The Messenger. Those 7 years which I spent with these wandering shepherds were the most peaceful and contented years of my life. I had already had a rich and varied experience. I was born of English parents in Paris and lived in France for 9 years. Later, I was educated at Eton and at the Royal Military College at Sandhurst. Then I spent 6 years as a British Army officer in India, where I played polo and hunted and explored in the Himalayas, as well as doing some soldiering. I fought through the First World War, and at its close, I was sent to the Paris Peace Conference as an assistant military attaché. I was shocked and disappointed at what I saw there. During the 4 years of slaughter on the Western Front, I had believed we were fighting to save civilization. But at the Paris Peace Conference, I saw selfish politicians laying the groundwork for the Second World War, each country grabbing all it could for itself, creating national antagonisms, and reviving the intrigues of secret diplomacy. I was sick of war, sick of the army, sick of society. For the first time in my career, I spent sleepless nights worrying about what I should do with my life. Lloyd George urged me to go in for politics. I was considering taking his advice when a strange thing happened, a strange thing that shaped and determined my life for the next 7 years. It all came from a conversation with Ted Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, the most colorful and romantic figure produced by the First World War. He had lived in the desert with the Arabs, and he advised me to do the same thing. At first, it sounded fantastic. However, I was determined to leave the army, and I had to do something. Civilian employers did not want to hire men like me, ex-officers of the regular army, especially when the labor market was jammed with millions of unemployed. So I did as Lawrence suggested. I went to live with the Arabs. I am glad I did so. They taught me how to conquer worry. Like all faithful Muslims, they are fatalists. They believe that every word which Muhammad wrote in the Quran is the divine revelation of Allah. So when the Quran says, God created you and all your actions, they accept it literally. That is why they take life so calmly and never hurry or get into unnecessary tempers when things go wrong. They know that what is ordained is ordained, and no one but God can alter anything. However, that doesn't mean that in the face of disaster, they sit down and do nothing. To illustrate, let me tell you of a fierce, burning windstorm of the Scirocco which I experienced when I was living in the Sahara. It howled and screamed for 3 days and nights. It was so strong, so fierce, that it blew sand from the Sahara hundreds of miles across the Mediterranean and sprinkled it over the Rhone Valley in France. The wind was so hot, I felt as if the hair was being scorched off my head. My throat was parched, my eyes burned, my teeth were full of grit. I felt as if I were standing in front of a furnace at a glass factory. I was driven as near crazy as a man can be and retain his sanity. But the Arabs didn't complain. They shrugged their shoulders and said, Maktub, it is written. But immediately after the storm was over, they sprang into action. They slaughtered all the lambs because they knew they would die anyway, and by slaughtering them at once, they hoped to save the mother sheep. After the lambs were slaughtered, the flocks were driven southward to water. This was all done calmly, without worry or complaining or mourning over their losses. The tribal chief said, "It is not too bad. We might have lost everything, but praise God, we have 40% of our sheep left to make a new start." I remember another occasion when we were motoring across the desert and a tire blew out. The chauffeur had forgotten to mend the spare tire, so there we were with only three tires. I fussed and fumed and got excited and asked the Arabs what we were going to do. They reminded me that getting excited wouldn't help, that it only made one hotter. The blown-out tire, they said, was the will of Allah, and nothing could be done about it. So we started on, crawling along on the rim of a wheel. Presently, the car sputtered and stopped. We were out of gas. The chief merely remarked, "Maktoub," and there again, instead of shouting at the driver because he had not taken on enough gas, everyone remained calm, and we walked to our destination, singing as we went. The 7 years I spent with the Arabs convinced me that the neurotics, the insane, the drunks of America and Europe, are the product of the hurried and harassed lives we live in our so-called civilization. As long as I lived in the Sahara, I had no worries. I found there, in the Garden of Allah, the serene contentment and physical well-being that so many of us are seeking with tenseness and despair. Many people scoff at fatalism. Maybe they're right, who knows? But all of us must be able to see how our fates are often determined for us. For example, if I had not spoken to Lawrence of Arabia at 3 minutes past noon on a hot August day in 1919, all the years that have elapsed since then would have been completely different. Looking back over my life, I can see how it has been shaped and molded time and again by events far beyond my control. The Arabs call it Maktoub, Kismet, the will of Allah. Call it anything you wish. It does strange things to you. I only know that today, 17 years after leaving the Sahara, I still maintain that happy resignation to the inevitable which I learned from the Arabs. That philosophy has done more to settle my nerves than 1,000 sedatives could have achieved. When the fierce burning winds blow over our lives and we cannot prevent them, let us too accept the inevitable, and then get busy and pick up the pieces. 5 Methods I Have Used to Banish Worry by Professor William Lyon Phelps. I had the privilege of spending an afternoon with Billy Phelps of Yale shortly before his death. Now, here are the 5 methods he used to banish worry based on the notes I took during that interview. Number 1. When I was 24 years old, my eyes suddenly gave out. After reading 3 or 4 minutes, my eyes felt as if they were full of needles. And even when I was not reading, they were so sensitive that I could not face a window. I consulted the best oculist in New Haven and New York. Nothing seemed to help me. After 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I simply sat in a chair in the darkest corner of the room, waiting for bedtime. I was terrified. I feared that I would have to give up my career as a teacher and go out west and get a job as a lumberjack. Then a strange thing happened, which shows the miraculous effects of the mind over physical ailments. When my eyes were at their worst that unhappy winter, I accepted an invitation to address a group of undergraduates. The hall was illuminated by huge rings of gas jets suspended from the ceiling. The lights pained my eyes so intensely that while sitting on the platform I was compelled to look at the floor. Yet during my 30-minute speech, I felt absolutely no pain, and I could look directly at these lights without any blinking whatever. Then, when the assembly was over, my eyes pained me again. I thought then that if I could keep my mind strongly concentrated on something, not for 30 minutes, but for a week, I might be cured. For clearly, it was a case of mental excitement triumphing over a bodily illness. I had a similar experience later, while crossing the ocean. I had an attack of lumbago so severe that I could not walk. I suffered extreme pain when I tried to stand up straight. While in that condition, I was invited to give a lecture on shipboard. As soon as I began to speak, every trace of pain and stiffness left my body. I stood up straight, moved about with perfect flexibility, and spoke for an hour. When the lecture was over, I walked away to my stateroom with ease. For a moment, I thought I was cured, but the cure was only temporary. The lumbago resumed its attack. These experiences demonstrated to me the vital importance of one's mental attitude. They taught me the importance of enjoying life while you may. So I live every day now as if it were the first day I had ever seen and the last I were going to see. I'm excited about the daily adventure of living, and nobody in a state of excitement will be unduly troubled with worries. I love my daily work as a teacher. I wrote a book entitled The Excitement of Teaching. Teaching has always been more than an art or an occupation to me. It is a passion. I love to teach as a painter loves to paint or a singer loves to sing. Before I get out of bed in the morning, I think with ardent delight of my first group of students. I have always felt that one of the chief reasons for success in life is enthusiasm. Number two, I have found that I can crowd worry out of my mind by reading an absorbing book. When I was 59, I had a prolonged nervous breakdown. During that period, I began reading David Alec Wilson's monumental Life of Carlyle. It had a good deal to do with my convalescence because I became so absorbed in reading it that I forgot my despondency. Number three. At another time, when I was terribly depressed, I forced myself to become physically active almost every hour of the day. I played five or six sets of violent games of tennis every morning, then took a bath, had lunch, played 18 holes of golf every afternoon. On Friday nights, I danced until 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm a great believer in working up a tremendous sweat. I found that depression and worry oozed out of my system with the sweat. Number four, I learned long ago to avoid the folly of hurry, rush, and working under tension. I've always tried to apply the philosophy of Wilbur Cross. When he was governor of Connecticut, he said to me, "Sometimes when I have too many things to do all at once, I sit down and relax and smoke my pipe for an hour and do nothing." Number five, I have also learned that patience and time have a way of resolving our troubles. When I'm worried about something, I try to see my troubles in their proper perspective. I say to myself, 2 months from now, I shall not be worrying about this bad break, so why worry about it now? Why not assume now the same attitude that I will have 2 months from now? To sum up, here are the five ways in which Professor Phelps banished worry. 1. Live with gusto and enthusiasm. I live every day as if it were the first day I have ever seen and the last I were going to see. 2. Read an interesting book. When I had a prolonged nervous breakdown, I began reading The Life of Carlyle and became so absorbed in reading that I forgot my despondency. 3. Play games. When I was terribly depressed, I forced myself to become physically active almost every hour of the day. 4. Relax while you work. I long ago learned to avoid the folly of hurry, rush, and working under tension. 5. I try to see my troubles in their proper perspective. I say to myself, 2 months from now, I shall not be worrying about this bad break, so why worry about it now? Why not assume now the same attitude that I will have 2 months from now? I Stood Yesterday, I Can Stand Today, by Dorothy Dix. I've been through the depths of poverty and sickness. When people ask me what's kept me going through all the troubles that come to all of us, I always reply, I stood yesterday, I can stand today, and I will not permit myself to think about what might happen tomorrow. I have known want and struggle and anxiety and despair. I've always had to work beyond the limit of my strength. As I look back upon my life, I see it as a battlefield strewn with the wrecks of dead dreams and broken hopes and shattered illusions, a battle in which I always fought with the odds tremendously against me, and which has left me scarred and bruised and maimed and old before my time. Yet I have no pity for myself. no tears to shed over the past and gone sorrows, no envy for the women who have been spared all I've gone through, for I have lived, they only existed. I have drunk the cup of life down to its very dregs. They have only sipped the bubbles on top of it. I know things they will never know. I see things to which they are blind. It is only the women whose eyes have been washed clear with tears who get the broad vision that makes them little sisters to all the world. I have learned in the great university of hard knocks a philosophy that no woman who has had an easy life ever acquires. I have learned to live each day as it comes, not to borrow trouble by dreading the morrow. It is the dark menace of the picture that makes cowards of us. I put that dread from me because experience has taught me that when the time comes that I so fear, the strength and wisdom to meet it will be given me. Little annoyances no longer have the power to affect me. After you've seen your whole edifice of happiness topple and crash in ruins about you, it never matters to you again that a servant forgets to put the doilies under the finger bowls or the cook spills the soup. I have learned not to expect too much of people, and so I can still get happiness out of the friend who isn't quite true to me or the acquaintance who gossips. Above all, I have acquired a sense of humor, because there were so many things over which I had either to cry or laugh. And when a woman can joke over her troubles instead of having hysterics, nothing can ever hurt her much again. I do not regret the hardships I have known, because through them I have touched life at every point I have lived, and it was worth the price I had to pay. Dorothy Dix conquered worry by living in day-tight compartments. I Did Not Expect to Live to See the Dawn by J.C. Penney. On April 14, 1902, a young man with $500 in cash and $1 million in determination opened a dry goods store in Kemmerer, Wyoming, a little mining town of 1,000 people situated on the old covered wagon trail laid out by the Lewis and Clark expedition. That young man and his wife lived in a half-story attic above the store, using a large empty dry goods box for a table and smaller boxes for chairs. The young wife wrapped her baby in a blanket and let it sleep under a counter while she stood beside it, helping her husband wait on customers. Today, the largest chain of dry goods stores in the world bears that man's name, the J.C. Penney stores, over 1,600 of them, covering every state in the Union. I recently had dinner with Mr. Penney, and he told me about the most dramatic moment of his life. Years ago, I passed through a most trying experience. I was worried and desperate. My worries were not connected in any way whatever with the J.C. Penney Company, and that business was solid and thriving. But I personally had made some unwise commitments prior to the crash of 1929. Like many other men, I was blamed for conditions for which I was in no way responsible. I was so harassed with worries that I couldn't sleep and developed an extremely painful ailment known as the shingles, a red rash and skin eruptions. I consulted a physician, a man with whom I'd gone to high school as a boy in Hamilton, Missouri, Dr. Elmer Eggleston, a staff physician at the Kellogg Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. Dr. Eggleston put me to bed and warned me that I was a very ill man. A rigid treatment was prescribed, but nothing helped. I got weaker day by day. I was broken nervously and physically, filled with despair, unable to see even a ray of hope. I had nothing to live for. I felt I hadn't a friend left in the world, that even my family had turned against me. One night, Dr. Eggleston gave me a sedative, but the effect soon wore off, and I awoke with an overwhelming conviction that this was my last night of life. Getting out of bed, I wrote farewell letters to my wife and to my son, saying that I did not expect to live to see the dawn. When I awoke the next morning, I was surprised to find that I was still alive. Going downstairs, I heard singing in a little chapel where devotional exercises were held each morning. I can still remember the hymn they were singing, "God Will Take Care of You." Going into the chapel, I listened with a weary heart to the singing, the reading of the scripture lesson, and the prayer. Suddenly, something happened. I can't explain it. I can only call it a miracle. I felt as if I had been instantly lifted out of the darkness of a dungeon into warm, brilliant sunlight. I felt as if I had been transported from hell to paradise. I felt the power of God as I had never felt it before. I realized then that I alone was responsible for all my troubles. I knew that God, with His love, was there to help me. From that day to this, my life has been free from worry. I am 71 years old, and the most dramatic and glorious 20 minutes of my life were those I spent in that chapel that morning. God will take care of you. J.C. Penney learned to overcome worry almost instantaneously because he discovered the one perfect cure. I go to the gym to punch the bag or take a hike outdoors, by Colonel Eddie Egan, New York attorney, Rhodes Scholar, former chairman, New York State Athletic Commission, former Olympic light heavyweight champion of the world. When I find myself worrying and mentally going around in endless circles, like a camel turning a water wheel in Egypt, a good physical workout helps me to chase those blues away. It may be running or a long hike in the country, or it may be a half hour of bag punching or squash tennis at the gymnasium. Whichever it is, physical exercise clears my mental outlook. On a weekend, I do a lot of physical sport, such as a run around the golf course, a game of paddle tennis, or a ski weekend in the Adirondacks. By my becoming physically tired, my mind gets a rest from legal problems, so that when I return to them, my mind has a new zest and power. Quite often in New York, where I work, there's a chance for me to spend an hour at the Yale Club gym. Now, no man can worry while he's playing squash tennis or skiing. He's too busy to worry. The large mental mountains of trouble become minute molehills that new thoughts and acts quickly smooth down. I find the best antidote for worry is exercise. Use your muscles more and your brain less when you're worried, and you'll be surprised at the result. It works that way with me. Worry goes when exercise begins. I Was the Worrying Wreck from Virginia Tech, by Jim Birdsall. Now, 17 years ago, when I was in military college at Blacksburg, Virginia, I was known as the Worrying Wreck from Virginia Tech. I worried so violently that I often became ill. In fact, I was ill so often that I had a regular bed reserved for me at the college infirmary at all times. When the nurse saw me coming, she'd run and give me a hypo. I worried about everything. Sometimes I even forgot what I was worrying about. I worried for fear I would be busted out of college because of my low grades. I'd failed to pass my examination in physics and other subjects, too. I knew I had to maintain an average grade of 75 to 84. I worried about my health, about my excruciating attacks of acute indigestion, about my insomnia. I worried about financial matters. I felt bad because I couldn't buy my girl candy or take her to dances as often as I wanted to. I worried for fear she'd marry one of the other cadets. I was in a lather day and night over a dozen intangible problems. In desperation, I poured out my troubles to Professor Duke Baird, professor of business administration at VPI. The 15 minutes that I spent with Professor Baird did more for my health and happiness than all the rest of the 4 years I spent in college. "Jim," he said, "you ought to sit down and face the facts. If you devoted half as much time and energy to solving your problems as you do to worrying about them, you wouldn't have any worries. Worrying is just a vicious habit you've learned." He gave me 3 rules to break the worry habit. Rule 1, find out precisely what is the problem you're worrying about. Rule 2, find out the cause of the problem. Rule 3, do something constructive at once about solving the problem. After that interview, I did a bit of constructive planning. Instead of worrying because I'd failed to pass physics, I now asked myself why I had failed. I knew it wasn't because I was dumb, for I was editor-in-chief of the Virginia Tech Engineer. I figured that I'd failed physics because I had no interest in the subject. I'd not applied myself because I couldn't see how it would help me in my work as an industrial engineer. But now I changed my attitude. I said to myself, If the college authorities demand that I pass my physics examination before I obtain a degree, who am I to question their wisdom? So I enrolled for physics again. This time, I passed, because instead of wasting my time in resentment and worrying about how hard it was, I studied diligently. I solved my financial worries by taking on some additional jobs, such as selling punch at the college dances, and by borrowing money from my father, which I paid back soon after.